Jews. Gentlemen, when you open the New Testament, you will find that sometimes the new era in which we ourselves live today is called the end of the partition between the Jews and the Greeks. And sometimes it's a question of Jews and Gentiles, where then the Greeks would be just one part of the Gentiles. This is, as you may now begin to understand, very reasonable. The Greeks have compromised between the tribal and the country system and tried to get between them as sailors, as livers, the people living between the tribes and the empires, exposed in the Mediterranean to two different backgrounds. So when you hear a sermon in which this is quoted, Greeks and Jews, or Jews and Gentiles as you speak today, both means the same thing. The Greeks are neither tribesmen, nor are they Egyptians or Chinese. Everybody feels this who looks at a Greek temple. It is not like an Egyptian temple as you have seen them in the movies. And it is not the same as a Red Indian in Greek. So today I want to complete the story how the Greeks made out of two orders one, and how the Jews steered clear of both orders and took us forward and enabled you and me to outlive this antiquity. We have today a world which came after the end of the world, the end of the ancient world. And there's a famous verse in Chesterton's Ballad of the White Horse, "And the end of the world was long ago." That's the year zero of our era. There the old world of the separation of tribes, of empires, of Romans, Jews, Greeks and Jews ended. And you cannot understand your own situation if you do not know that we all live after the end of the world. Modern man is so Greek that he pokes fun at this. For Greeks there is no end of the world because he thinks cyclical. But so most academic people in this country had to be shocked into the awareness that there is something like eschatology. For the last 10 years, our poor American brains have been tortured by the new invention of the word eschatology. That is the doctrine of last things, or apocalyptic. That's another word that's today a little bit more in use than before. But the simple fact is, gentlemen, that what was announced, the end of antiquity in the year zero, when with the coming of Christ, was finally carried into conclusion in this last century. And today, nobody can afford to be just a Jew, or just a Greek, or just a tribesman, or just an Egyptian or Chinese. The empires have fallen. 11 empires were destroyed in the 19th and 20th century. All the last empires of antiquity. The Austro-Hungarian, the Russian, the Chinese, the Japanese, the Hindu, because the King of England was Emperor of India, and that's gone, it's a republic now. And the Emperor of Brazil, the Emperor of Germany. So there are no empires left. But it takes for history, gentlemen, sometimes 1900 years to achieve one program. The fall of empires began with the coming of Christ, with the declaration that no man could be God. And it took 1900 years before this is carried into execution. The difficulty of our era is, gentlemen, that in many ways only today can we be Christians. Because there were still Jews. Now there aren't. They have now the state of Israeli. So no Jew in America can simply be a Jew because he has to decide either he goes to Israeli or does he still wait for the Messiah. If he can't wait for the Messiah, he can't be a Jew.
It's a very difficult situation. Most people dodge the issue. But it is true that with the founding of Israel, the whole religious campaign of the last 1900 years, in a certain extent, is at an end. If you open the New Testament and read Romans 11, St. Paul said at the very moment that the Jews will be back to their own, you see, realm, the whole mission is changed, the whole transformation of the world. You don't live anymore in the year of the Lord 1900 or 1850. You live after two world wars, gentlemen. And you don't want to accept this. You want to be children. But on your generation has fallen this tremendous responsibility to realize that the year 1945 and the year of the crucifixion have very much with each other to do. The program set out at that time is finished. And now you all live in an era in which you all know that you are the heirs of all four qualities: kingship, prophecy, poetry, and priesthood. And nobody can say I'm this for one or for the other. Not one of you can. Practically, you all already do these things. But now even your mind has to participate in your doing. The school mind, and I mean the Greek mind, is, as I told you last time, the mind that deals with other orders of existence outside our own. That is the Greek mind. It compares. And therefore, as soon as a Greek mind touches on religion, for example, it is funny. When professors deal with religion, it is very funny. I can only talk about religion as a layman, because I can only have one religion. But as soon as a Greek man speaks, he can speak of many religions, so he has none. He doesn't know what religion is. Religion is where I have singleness of purpose. So all this nonsense of comparison of religion, which Mr. Davis studies, this is just nonsense, sir. Absolute nonsense. Because religion is where you shut out plurality, where you say, this is my way of life. As soon as you say I have many ways of life, or there are many ways of life, you look at the world from the outside as a Greek who travels between all these various temples and religions and tribes and says, well, here this man lives this way, this man lives the other way, and I compare. So what I try to do in this course, gentlemen, is to redeem you from your own Greek mind, to show you that nobody who lives can just be a Greek. Greek is an interim activity of study, of orientation. But later on, gentlemen, every one of you has to choose his single path. You cannot remain in this mental Olympus, in this mental academic, what you call ivory tower, or library, Baker Library, or this classroom, with many possibilities, gentlemen. So the difficulty of talking to students, gentlemen, about antiquity or about reality is that you all identify yourself at this moment with this Greek mind of comparison. You are outside life. Most of you are not married, fortunately. And so you still can compare. You are not committed. But this is an interim existence, a highly unnatural existence, gentlemen. And it is a transient existence. The student, gentlemen, or the Greeks are transient. They can only be used in an interim, in between final orders. The Greek mind is the temporal mind. Today we speak of the secular mind. You have heard that modern man is secularized. Who has heard this term? Well, gentlemen, it's a poor word. Use temporalized. That is, your mind is interested in one thing after another. And it is that comes out more clearly if you speak of temporal. It's the same meaning. Saeculum in Latin means passing of this time, of one time only, not forever. It's the opposite to eternity. But it is not quite the right word. It's a too polite word. If you say secular, it doesn't cry for its opposite. Whereas if you say temporal or transient, it is obvious that there could be always something more permanent. This is my difficulty now in taking you back once more to these two achievements of the Greek mind and the Jewish heart. Opposed are two different emphases, two different aspects. Of course, Jews and Greeks are both human beings. If you begin with Homer, there is much universal religion in Greeks that they have in common with the Jews. For example, the Babylonian building of the Babylonian Tower in the Old Testament is matched in the Greek mythology by the tradition of the Titans, who tower, who build one mountain on top of the other to get into the sky. In the original beginnings of Greece and Judaism, the people both had the same yearning. You see it with the story of Noah and the story of Dionysus, whereas the old empires celebrated the wheat and the bull and the plow and the agriculture. I've mentioned this to you. And you find in Noah suddenly a stress on the production of the wine that makes men drunk. And there's description in the Bible how deeply drunk Noah finally is found by his sons and how dastardly they behave towards his drunkenness. Well, obviously, the same problem exists in the beginning of the Greek tradition with Dionysus. The god, we talked about this god of youth, this god of drunkenness, this god of ecstasy. And with Noah and Dionysus, you have again something that shows that both these nations were concerned with one gift of the good earth, which makes people imitate the divine inspiration, you can say. It's an artificially induced enthusiasm, which we get by drunkenness. And if you have no spirit, you need spirits. That's an old story. Wine replaces the inspiration. You don't know this, gentlemen. You drink because you have a guilt complex, and you even drink alone. Reasonable people drink in company. And because they are inspired, the good use of wine and alcohol is that you see that you add to your own good spirits and express it by wine. In this country, there's a terrible tradition. You see that when a man is melancholic, he pours himself a glass of whiskey. Well, he goes to hell right away. Because if you are sad, you must weep. If you rejoice, you must drink. Rejoicing is underscored by alcohol, by wine, you see. You do it for the opposite reason. That's why it is not becoming. I don't believe that any American student wants to drink beer. It's just a habit. In other countries, they like beer. But here, you drink just because it is something rash or bold or audacious to drink. For absolute nonsense. I have always the feeling that you would all feel much more happy if there was no drinking at all on this campus. No, not one of you wants to drink. But it is only that you have to break a taboo. So you tell yourself all the time how independent you are, that you can drink beer or can drink liquor. It's funny. If you really follow your own deepest instinct, you would not drink. Because, gentlemen, drink is only enjoyable, and the natural use of drink is only for the group. It is absolutely nothing for one or two men on your room. To drink in your own room is absolutely fatal. But for an occasion, at a real wedding, but who celebrates a wedding here? Weddings are receptions here, funerals. You see, where you all get high, then you can. It is natural to drink, but then you wouldn't drink whiskey or gin or not these terrible cocktails. Cocktails are an insult, I think, to humanity. See, I think so. Because before you can have any mood, you are already drunk. Two cocktails and you're knocked out. And that's the essence of it. That's why enemies, business enemies, can get together at cocktail parties without shooting each other. But why do you do this, gentlemen? You are young and you are not in competition so much. And why must you imitate these robber barons?
Called, now they are called God Almighty corporations.
Well, only to show you that there are serious parallels in the first beginning of Greece and Judaism. The roads of these two people is not quite as far apart as it looks at the end. Judaism and biblical faith are farthest apart at the end of antiquity. See, that's again against the books. But the specialization increases. If you want to read, want to know what the Greek at the end of their odyssey, of their errancy is, you may read the memoirs of Emperor Marcus Aurelius, towards himself. It's the great diary of the Emperor of Rome. Pure story, pure Greek philosophy, and the opposite from any biblical faith. A lonely man revolving the world in his mind, not receiving orders, but trying to get organized with his mind towards objectively your own ideal. Your own mind, I think, spelled out large. A very sad man, and a very impotent man, and a disaster for the Roman Empire. What happens to the Greek mind, gentlemen? The Greek mind wants to be objective and outside these orders. He wants to look at these orders, which demand sacrifice and discipline and war and observation of festivals and of calendar discipline. He wants to get outside the discipline of war and the discipline of work. The tribe has no discipline of work, but discipline of war. Migration including war. War and migration is, so to speak, being the same thing. You see, the enterprise, a campaign, the march. On the march, the tribe is at its best. The empires in the settlement are at their best, so there's a discipline of work. The very opposite, you remember. The diversification of technical skills. The Greeks try to get out of both. Division of labor and martial law are for the Greek mind only here up to the collar, so to speak. They try to stick their neck out or their head outside above this collar and look around and dominate these two orders, as you do, very much like the eternal student, the Greek. How do they do it, gentlemen? They call everything that is not tribe and not empire nature. The Greeks have invented a very funny idea in which you all believe. This word physis is in Latin nature, natura, and unfortunately in English it is also now in use nature. You should use the word world. World is better for than nature. But I can't alter the fact that you are all believe in nature and you no longer know what the world is. The world is something that overawes us, gentlemen. But nature is something for which Mr. Thoreau has even found, and Mr. Rousseau have even founded, a kind of religion. And most Dartmouth boys believe that they must commune with nature and that you can worship nature. Well, worship, nature is a self-made goddess. It is the world outside the two orders of the family and of the state. Outside your work and outside your walk. And that's very easy, to, if you deduct the two serious orders, which really make demands on you, and call the rest nature, then nature looks very innocent and very nice. That is nature to you. You have never investigated, gentlemen, clearly, what you do not call nature. Now, you don't call the Church of Christ in Hanover nature. You don't call Dartmouth College nature. You don't call the government in Washington nature. And if you are in your five senses, you don't call your father natural, because if it is a natural father, he isn't your father. We call a child of nature a child that has no legitimate father. The opposite of nature is the law. The law is that which is man-made, and the Greeks oppose, therefore, not nature and law. Today that's very difficult for you to understand, because you have figured out talk about natural law. But at this moment, we have to go back to antiquity. And there the opposition is, nature is that at which a man can look without immediate commitment of himself on the warpath for his ancestors or for the defense of his frontiers in his city. You see, they are not natural. They are spiritual. You must know that the word nature does not exist in Egypt or in the tribe. I told you that for the tribe, the world is animated. How can it be nature? That's my own spirit that the serpent has, or the lion. I and the lion have one spirit. So they are not separated from me as nature, and I against them with my mind, you see. And we are the same breed, are we not, you see? They have a spirit, I have a spirit. We try to speak to each other. In all fairy tales, the animals and the people speak to each other. There is no nature, because there is no mind. Objectively, you're looking at nature. Can you begin to understand this? There is no nature, gentlemen, where I myself am articulating nature. The nightingale singing is articulating the beauty of nightingales and of the world. She's the mouthpiece of the universe. I am too, gentlemen. I'm not a Greek. I don't live in nature. I have never met with nature. I decline to commune with nature. To me, this is all nonsense. All these nature poetry. Nature speaks through me. That is, in myself, I am full of cosmic energies. I'm a creature. The creature is not the same as nature. Because nature can be separated from my mind, gentlemen. But God created me body and soul. And if I say something here at this moment, gentlemen, it is inside the cosmic process. I'm not facing any, confronted with anything. But through me, the universe tries to reach you. I'm uttering certain sounds that have now to be made in the life of the universe. I cannot split myself off. How can the drum or the pipe or the clarinet or the violin be separated from the universe whose tones it formulates? I'm articulating the universe, gentlemen, as a creature, you see. But the Greek mind looks at nature, and it is your curse that you try to do the same. That is, gentlemen, anybody who objectifies nature is on the way to schizophrenia, becomes schizophrenic, because he doubles himself. I give you the most outstanding Greek example that I've ever met with in modern times. Is quite a well-known man, Professor Wolfgang Köhler. He's a psychologist. He was professor at the University of Berlin. He's quite famous because he investigated on the Canary Islands the intelligence of the apes, of the monkeys, the larger kind. And obviously, that had some influence on his thinking. He thought he was very near to humanity in investigating these apes. And he came to Cambridge We are very good friends. And he gave away the secret of the Greek mind. He gave a lecture there. And he said it was his ideal to attend an operation on his own brain and to be able to look at himself while the brain, the organ with which he thought and could look at himself, was operated upon. Now that's an extreme case of split. But I want to invite you to consider this very seriously, gentlemen. As long as you believe in nature, and as long as you believe in the human mind, you drive a wedge in the integrity of your own unity. I am a flute, and my maker plays on it. Mr. Wolfgang Köhler is a professor who tries to objectify even his own body in such an extent that while he is in danger of life and is operated upon, he wants to look with the same organ on which the surgeon is now operating, you see, what the surgeon is doing. It's absolute perverse. But it is the Greek mind ideal, and it is your ideal. And that's why you can't love but have only no sex. Sex is love when you try to look at it. If you are healthy, you just are in love. And all the rest is expression of this, articulation of it. But if you want to study love, sex, you buy Wanderwelle or some such interesting book, and you look at the situation, and you can't love anymore. It's just a dirty cross. In America, this just goes rampant. People think that to recommend nature is to make a real recommendation, gentlemen. It's the destruction of your integrity. When we are overwhelmed by a feeling, we sing. Or when we are impressed by an experience, we speak. An historian is overwhelmed by an event, he must take us through a World War I. And so, then comes the Homer. That's the historian of the First Great World War, isn't it? You see. But he didn't look at the World War. But the World War threw its waves into this man, and out of Homer came the Iliad. That's how great works are written, you see. Testifying that this man is under the weather, that he's overwhelmed by the event, that he's under pressure. The mind wants to be outside the pressure. You want to stick your neck out so wide out that you are no longer under pressure. And then what you see, gentlemen, is a lifeless, what you call nature, what Mr. Einstein described as the universe. Thank you. Do you really think we could be alive if this is the universe? What the physicists describe as? This is nonsense. How can it be? Here I live, you live, gentlemen, and then we are told that we are electrons. Isn't that funny? Who can believe such stuff? Certainly not the physicists themselves. They go now into monasteries. They have nothing to do with electrons. They're running away from their own results. But you believe all this nonsense, gentlemen. Nature is a self-made Buddha of mankind. We are all Buddhists in this sense. You all believe that what your mind has thought out by getting outside reality, nature exists. Doesn't exist. God created obviously a lump of a business of a world in which we are his eyes and ears and mind to speak, to testify, to act, to unify. Obviously, who are we, gentlemen? We are this one bacteria on this globe that has to make the globe one. You can compare us to simple bacteria. But we are doing something, hopping around like men, aren't we? Driven by some impulse that we must unite the globe. And we are doing pretty well, you know. But only as long as you admit that we are forced, you see, that's our destiny. We are meant to do this. We can't look at this thing from the outside. We are moving. We have just as much a function on this globe as all other people, and the function is not to look at things, but to perform. Just as a lion has to eat and to roar, so we have to eat and to study. But to study is just as much a function of our fulfillment that is not getting outside the world and looking at it. Oh, there's nowhere to get outside. So this is the great creation, however, gentlemen, this illusion that the mind can look at nature. Wherever you find the mind in nature, you find the Greek at work. There's another word by which you can recognize the Greek mind. It's now in English in use with a Latin translation, but it is the Greek principle. It's the word principle. The word principle, gentlemen, in Greek it means arche. You have to know the word archaic, and the Greek word archont, the ruler of the city in Athens. Now, arche means both rule and beginning. The New Testament, for example, in Greek reads, in the beginning was the word, in arche. Arche, you may take this down, gentlemen, as in the Greek version, A-R-C-H-E, for the Latin word principle. A principle, gentlemen, is a compromise between the tribal pedigree and the astronomical experiences of the Egyptians. Principle is an abstraction, so to speak, valid for the return of the constellations in the sky as much as the beginning of an ancestor pedigree. You see, in the beginning was Wodan or Zeus or Odin or somebody, you see, or Romulus, and all the other Romans descend from Romulus. The name-giving hero is the principle of any Greek city, but also you understand we use principle now when you have a real Roman conviction like Daniel Webster and you speak on by principle. Wherever you find a secular mind, the only thing he can defend himself with or can reason things out is by principle. We stand on principle. One of the most funny standing I know. I wouldn't like to stand on principle, gentlemen, because then I would be dated. Principle is what I thought yesterday. But this is a good American tradition because in the 19th century, the world went Greek, tried to go as far in Greek thinking as possible. So the word principle is very famous among you. You think that you, if a man stands on principle, he is very wise. Well, he's a Greek. The Greeks did stand on principle. There's another similar word in Latin, which I may, for the fun of it, analyze, by which you can see how the Greeks and the Romans were only their stepbrothers and their nephews, so to speak. They imitated the Greeks. How they tried to draw conclusions which would summarize the tribal and the Egyptian tradition. The word origin is a very funny composite. The first half of origin has to do with the Orient. It means the sunrise. And it is clearly a hint at the orientation from the astronomical constellations in the sky. If you take the word oriri, which is of which Orient is a participle, you see, it means to rise. So, ori is for taken from the rise of the sun, and you would expect then that origin points to the fact that we take all our principles, all our origins, from the observation of the stars. That would be true of the Egyptian influence on Rome and Greece. Now you take the second half of the word, jinn. It isn't jinn, but it's in Latin, G-E-N. And it comes from genes and from genetics. It means to be begotten, to genealogy is the same word. And there you have a tribal root. And so the strange Latin language has formed this compound in which the tribal motivation, genealogy, and the Egyptian motivation, sunrise, are juxtaposed in a strange hybrid form. The word origin certainly is one of the most interesting words because it covers two layers of human thinking. Okay. Sunrise thinking, so to speak, astronomical thinking, we would say, and genetical thinking, descent, you see, by birth.
and by marriage. And says the truth, the origins of Rome is in both, because Rome has a temple which is oriented according to the sun and to the stars, but it has also a genealogical principle. You have to be born from Roman parents in order to be a Roman citizen. So today, as you know, we speak very much of origins, not knowing, of course, how complicated the geology of this word is. The word origin is coined after these two words already existed, the tribal world and the imperial world. And it's in a way of taking stock. Things can be derived among people by origin, means they can come from tribal family, right, you see, from blood, or they can come from place. They can come from settlement, or they can come from migration. In both cases, we speak of the domineering principle as saying originally, you see. And then come these conquerors, these latecomers, this third group, the Greeks, the Romans, there are others, the Galatians, the Celts, and take over and penetrate into these empires and into these older tribal orders and mix them. And this we call now then the addition to the original. What would you oppose to original? What is the contrast to original?
Eternal.
What?
Eternal.
I don't see that there any contrast in eternal and original. See? What it would be the... I don't understand your logic, sir. Would you explain? Why would eternal be against original?
Well, because eternal would be without beginning and original would have some beginning.
Yeah, I'm afraid, however, eternal is really the sin, this eternal recurrence of the stars is much more than what we say with eternal, you see. Never, have no beginning and no end. That's what the Romans tried to say with the sunrise term. The original meant, you see, set by astronomy and set by pedigree.
Ultimate.
Well, if I say he's an original poet, I praise him, don't I? And if I oppose this, what would you say of a poet who is not original?
Eclectic.
See? Eclectic. Very good. Excellent. Thank you very much. Eclectic, you see? Having already a choice between things he hasn't himself created, he is not himself responsible for.
No, sir. That's too eclectic.
Pardon me? When I prepared this, I just received a book from Holland. Quite unexpectedly, it hits in the same way, which just came out and is written by a gentleman, Van Groningen, who is a professor of ancient Greek in the University of Leiden. And it's called In the Grip of the Past, an essay on an aspect of Greek thought. And to my amazement, he, so to speak, underpins everything I've here tried to tell you, and I've done it for years, in a special analysis of Greek style, Greek tragedy, Greek history, and he calls it In the Grip of the Past, but it is really, as he proves by his examples, more that it is in the grip of past and present. When you read today a book by a mathematician, by the famous Mr. Laplace, you can read this sentence, which is very Greek, that the past produces the present, and the past and the present together produce the future. That's stupid, that's Greek, and you don't know that it is stupid. There is no present in your experience. In your experience, there is only future and past. And how then the past can produce the present and the past and present together can produce the future, that's one of the necessities of the Greek mind that has no future.
There is no future. For the Jews, that is all nonsense, because the future conditions the present totally. That is dead in the present, which cannot reach the future, and that is alive in the present, that is already part of the future. So the future has already started yesterday. You see? And we remember only those things, gentlemen, as past, that are already the cornerstones of the future. We have talked about this in the first hour of the course. I come now back to this. We have already debated the Greek question before, you see, without telling you so. But you all, I know, are Greeks, and you believe that Mr. Laplace didn't say any nonsense when he said that the present and the past together produce the future. God forbid. If the past and the present would produce the future, there would be no future. Then there would be eternal recurrence. You see, there would never anything new could happen. Mr. Laplace write a book on physics, because that's a new thing. You see, that had never been written before.
Yeah.
Nature, mind, principle, origin are very simple little words. And in opposition to the great scenes of Homer, the Iliad, for which I spoke last time, they may have a sobering effect on you. This man here gives an even more harmless example. He says, whenever the Greeks use the phrase, not yet, they mean never. Because they reason that what hasn't happened cannot happen. It's very interesting that he proves this from Greek texts in a chapter called Language. He says, whenever the Greek writer says, not yet, he means to say, therefore never. So that very often when you read this phrase, not yet, in Greek, it's upo, who knows, kind of, you know Greek, don't you? See here? No. Illustrious through absence. So that not yet becomes never. Because Aristotle says in one place that what has happened can happen, but that what hasn't happened cannot happen. That's Greek logic. And that's what you call objectivity. You also prove, for example, when I came to this country, they proved that America would be an obsolescent country by 1960 because the majority of the people would be over 45. So, of course, as there was still a spark of life in this country, and so the prophets of doom had to be repudiated, men are free even to get too many children, so they do. And so all the statisticians are wrong. But from the Greek point of view, that's not possible, because since in 1935, the families were dwindling to always smaller and smaller size. The logic is, you see, it has not yet happened that families increase again, therefore it can't happen. You must laugh at these statisticians, gentlemen. Before you, we are not safe in this country. You must wake up to the limitations of the Greek mind. And you must know that this is the curse of the objectivity. Objectivity means that you yourself are not a factor in the life process. A colleague of mine, I'm told, in his class about marriage, was asked what his idea about marriage is. He said he had none. Well, gentlemen, then he shouldn't talk about marriage if he has none. If he only reported other people's opinions on marriage, he is destroying marriage, because marriages in all orders of humanity only live as long as every one of us contributes to their existence. The funny thing, you see, between a tribe or family and nature is that you can do relatively little to the Mont Blanc. But if you speak disparagingly about the religions or your father or your mother and say that your mother, that you want to sleep with your mother or some such nonsense, then you destroy marriage. That is, there is not a word in human society, gentlemen, that isn't either destructive or life-giving. And there is not a thought in your head that is not either life-giving or destructive. The illusion of the Greek is that he can declare all these things as to be natural so that he is not committed. It doesn't exist yet. If you say Europe is a great civilization, you have to make Europe exist. If you say Europe once was a great continent, now it's completely washed out. Look at France, just dead. Gentlemen, you condemn it. It dies because you say that it is dead. Any statement about life either increases the life or weakens the life. You cannot speak about living beings, gentlemen, as nature. There is no objectivity. It's nonsense. Fortunately not. With every word you either call into being or you execute. And these objectifiers, gentlemen, are nothing but killers, murderers. They may, sometimes it is necessary to kill. And some of the families which the analysts analyze just deserve to be killed because they're dead. They are divorced, the father has a mistress and the mother has three lovers. Well, then it's better to tell the child that it has no parents anymore. Therefore, for sick families, psychoanalysis may be a good thing. For healthy families, it's murder. And you don't distinguish between two things. You don't know that Mr. Freud, after all, only practiced on sick families, on families that didn't deserve to be saved. So you all go to the psychoanalyst and destroy your family. Because you are weaklings. You want to be comforted because you have some mishap in life. That's no reason to go to the psychoanalyst and help you to destroy the rest of the structure in which you live. But you are all Greeks, gentlemen. You all take this liberty and this shamelessness because the Greek mind, now comes the last thing, is shameless when it comes to facts. They make no distinction between shame and non-shame. Now, gentlemen, all living beings live only by postponing utterance, by tension, by patience, by waiting for the right moment to speak. You see, declare your love 5 minutes too early, she'll turn you down. You have to wait for the 1 hour in which it is ripe. Don't speak too early, and don't speak too late. And the same is true in politics. Any community has all the well-wishers and good-doers always among them, but they are terrible because they don't know when to act. They always wish for everything at once. There's nothing good doing, gentlemen. The man who has reverence or shame says, this may have to be said one time, but I still don't know when. So shame is nothing very moral, gentlemen. It is simply a deep immersion into the life process of the whole inside which we live. The cosmos, the creation, the world, as I say. But not nature. As soon as you talk about nature, nature has no doesn't put any obligation for you for the timing. You go out into nature, you kill all the redwood. You go out into nature, you go on hunting. You do as you please, because the rhythm, the time of nature and your time are not the same. You have your own time, your own principles. You want to write a book on nature and make money of it, so why not describe nature? It may be very harmful to the elf that you write a book. When the first book on Africa was written, you know, on the hunting of the elephant there, the tiger, it made a lot of money and it destroyed all the wildlife in Africa as a consequence. So if the man had any decency and any shame, he wouldn't have written his book, but it made money, went through all the editions. Now, in a few years, there won't be any wildlife in Africa because all the people from Chicago driving in their limousines and shooting from the how do you call the board there, bang, bang, bang. All the tigers are gone.
nature worship can either be nature destruction, gentlemen. But if you live inside the world, gentlemen, you do not distinguish between the tiger and your own existence. You are, share the rhythm of this world. And therefore, you're very careful not to give away the secret to people who don't deserve to know something. As you know, in your country here, you are very mentally sick because people travel in order to write a book. They go to the North Pole only in order to write, shoot a movie. Then that's the end of the world. That's the great mind running riot. I had a knew a couple, they even call themselves my friends, I'm ashamed to say, who decided they needed money. So they had to do something extravagant. So they decided to climb the Alps from Nice, from Monaco, from Grace Kelly to Vienna. Crosswise. Now all the valleys in the Alps run, you know, north-south or east-west in the French forest. And it is absolutely idiotic to traverse them, you see, in this manner. But it was, nobody had ever done it, you see.
It was really original in the Greek sense.
And so they said, it would be better. So they only made the trip in order to write the exotic book.
Now ask yourself, how many of you are in the same predicament, gentlemen, that you do something for publicity's sake?
That is, for exploiting the product by putting it under the nose of other people.
Whenever you do this, gentlemen, you go to hell. Don't marry for the approval of your parents. Or for the approval of anybody, for that matter, of course.
There you have a very clear case. Anybody goes to hell who marries for the satisfaction of somebody else, for the approval of somebody else, you see.
As you will admit, this is very simple. It looks very simple.
But it is with all our other actions, gentlemen. You cannot do anything in order to make it known that you have done it. Can you see this? That's not a good reason for any action. If the action is not determined in its own value, whether God alone sees it or everybody else knows it, you cannot act at all. Please omit the act. And certainly, these scoundrels who went there across the Alps, it's a very minor topic, therefore I mention it. They only reflect, gentlemen, millions of Americans today who do not think it wrong to act so that other people may know that they have done it. That's the whole story, gentlemen, in charities and in going to church. It is wise, it was wise, you have nearly probably forgotten it, from between 1947 and 1952, it was socially wise to go to church. Now it's wearing off, obviously. It's no longer necessary. So now a decent person can again go to church because he's no longer mistaken for these social climbers or these social security agents who don't want to have a McCarthy on their doorstep. But you learn to despise mankind when you live long enough, gentlemen. I have now seen these weather vans operate in Germany and operate in this country and go from one extreme to the other. One time in this country you had to be a communist, and the other time you had to be a fascist, and I don't know, now you have to be a corporation lawyer. It is very dirty, gentlemen, and you see that men live only to make other people see that they do something. This is, however, inevitable once you think that the mind can be the bystander of life. I'd like to scrunch this Greek side of the picture because then we will go over to the Old Testament and hide it away again by a story which shows you the perversion of the mind very clearly, I hope. It was in the First World War, and I was at the front, and I had been a soldier for 3 years. And of course, in the fighting lines, at that time we had no airmail, you were very far away from home. And
suddenly we woke up to the fact that the war was going bad, America entered the war, and so the Russian Revolution broke out, and so even a simple lieutenant at the front woke up to the fact that something was happening politically which was not very favorable. So I asked for, and I was already a professor of public law, of constitutional law at home, so I felt my obligation to learn something and to speak to people about my worries. And I asked for leave of absence from the front, and I went to Berlin. And I met this classmate of mine from school, who was in one of these safe positions in our Washington, I mean in one of these innumerable superfluous agencies. And you see, the real rift in a war is between the front and the home. You love your enemy on the front, but you hate the people at home. And that has brought on much tragedy between the soldiers in Korea, as you know, and the American home front. And especially, now I won't say anything about movie stars. But the gist of the matter was, this roommate, a classmate of mine, was willing to convene a meeting of our generation. I was 26 at that time. So people of that age, what they thought, there was a Russian Revolution in Moscow and St. Petersburg, and there were the Americans coming, and so what was Germany going to do? And we convened under the wonderful picture of the famous Böcklin, painter Böcklin, and you still see this, in a very smug atmosphere. And all these civilians, all these people, we call them reclaimed, you call them 4F, gathered, and I was the only man in uniform. And to my amazement, my friend, who was in the chair, because he was the host of the occasion, said, let us have a debate now on what we shall do when the people make a revolution. Because Russia, you see, world revolution, it was, you see, very much in the air. Lenin was already, had just taken over. It was the very time, it was November, beginning of November 1917, and the war was still, you see, this was all tense, all in between. I was flabbergasted over this question. What are you going to do when the people make a revolution? And so everyone, in this most formal and solemn way, said, well, if the people make a revolution, I guess I will join them. And I, at the end, was asked myself, and I said, for heaven's sake, where am I? I'm here in uniform. I am representative of the German government as much as any general or as any president of emperor. And I am the people. And you ask me whether, when the people make a revolution, I would join them? The only question before me is it necessary for the sake of Germany to make a revolution? Then I'm going to make it first. Or I'm against it, I'm for order and discipline, then I fight it. But to ask me whether, if the people make a revolution, I should join them, is the whole question. I can declare this to be a mob. Lawless people, gangsters. You see, before I say people, I must identify myself first. That's my judgment, my responsibility. And I can make a revolution single-handed. I don't need the mob for this. They didn't understand, and I didn't understand them, and you don't understand. But the gentlemen, that is the rift between the Greek mind and the people. Nobody who belongs to the people ever asked such an idiotic question. It's an insane question which the whole American intellectuals now ask. This whole intellectual group in this country deserves to be wiped out on the surface of the globe, because they all think that they have to look at the people and to study them and observe their behavior, like Croatian folklore. I'm folklore. I'm a Croatian. I'm a peasant. I'm just as superstitious as anybody else.
Therefore, I can awake up from my superstition. You are trying to be intellectuals. You say, you always talk about, in your papers, which you wrote for me, gentlemen, you always talk about pagans. You are pagan as much as you. You talk about folklore. You talk about superstitions. Gentlemen, you don't understand anything about life if you do not say first, I am superstitious. As long as you cannot identify yourself with the world as is, you see, and look at the rest of humanity as nature, you are Greek. You are split. Because you don't know the workings of your own mind. Aren't you full of superstition? Wasn't it for 2 years ago impossible to be a communist? Now it is a very good fashion to take a ticket and go to Russia. Don't you know how superstitious that is? Aren't you all victims of constant superstitions? The first thing a decent person says is to say, I am superstitious. I need myths. I live in a mythology. No, but you are enlightened, you are Greeks, you look at everything, you are so clever, so intelligent, gentlemen, that you have become the most stupid people on earth. Because a person who says that is not stupid is certainly stupid. And a person who says that he's not superstitious certainly is superstitious. You can only emerge from any part of your worldly existence by first searching that worldly part, and then you can diminish it. You see, you can become less superstitious. That's what we can do, you see. And a man who doesn't say that he is dependent on his parents, he cannot never conquer his freedom. If you are born with the conviction, I'm independent, then you, of course, will remain for the rest of your life at your mother's apron strings, as so many American boys who deny that they are dependent on your mother, so they have to stay. But once you say, of course I'm dependent on your mother, you can break away. You can limit the dependency, but always first by assuming your servitude, your dependency, your being part and parcel of the existing order of the world. We are beasts. We are animals. Of course we are. But gentlemen, only by saying this, we already begin to be able to limit this influence. But you do neither. You want to be objective. So you either say cynically, I'm a beast, don't change, or I'm a free man. It's both nonsense. You're neither free nor beast. You're something very strange in between. And only by the admission that you're both can you determine the proportion. But the Greek mind cannot do this because he hears this wonderful mind outside the stream of reality, and there's nature. And you think that you can look at nature like my friend Wolfgang Köhler, and he's quite betrayed. He cannot. He needs a doctor who puts him under anesthesia and who forbids him to look at his own operation. I think this, my story is, if you think this through, gentlemen, this vote describes the curse of the intelligentsia, the intellectual. And then their uselessness. People who in a crisis of their country can only ask, what am I going to do when the other people act? They have ceased to be a member of this group. A healthy member, gentlemen, hurries to the place where something has to be done perfectly under your own steam, under your own responsibility. I could go on and enlarge on the story of what happened to all these men who were at this route. I think I'm the only man who survived. They all tried, of course, to imitate then other people. Most of them became then social democrats, and were there all then got in trouble and were shot by the Nazis. They never were Marxians, but they thought the people were Marxians, so they had to join them. Never pays, gentlemen, to join in other men's conviction. So it's a story of the last 30 years, gentlemen, in millions of people, which I've tried to condense in this little anecdote. This is not a private story. It is your story, too. Most of you would never have found out
the moral of my story. You would have thought that was quite a normal question. What do I do when the people make revolution? If you are a real patriot, gentlemen, you would only be afraid to come too late. I mean, you should have, either you are the first to make revolution, or you are the last to fight it. You can be you can either adhere to the Ersia regime, or you can be the stormy petrel of the next order. But just to stand by and wait where the other people run, gentlemen, that's absolutely despicable. And I assure you that these people make themselves superfluous. Such people are not needed in the world. God's economy has absolutely no place for these people except as reporters in newspapers or commentators or broadcasters. But these are superfluous people too. I could do very well without all the broadcasters of the United States taken together and shipped to Antarctica. The world wouldn't change at all if you took all these commentators. They're perfectly, they are lucas. So have a break here.
We are in between. Therefore, everything the Greek's mind tells you seems to be convincing. I have to plead with you to understand that you are in a very unique and special locality when you go to a college or to a grammar school or to a high school. In all these classrooms, life is as bleak as these walls. You go into a family, there are beds and there's a stove and there is a kitchen and there is a toilet. And there's real life with all its implications of dirt, travail, sickness, danger, incidents and accidents, and misery. And there may be starvation. The people may be unemployed. All this is blotted out here in this wonderful world of the mind, gentlemen. The classroom reflects the effort of the human mind to go it alone. We are here, so to speak, regardless of your shoulders, your bowels, your stomach, your legs, and your arms, it's all the brain. Therefore, you emphasize, of course, your power of understanding foreign lands, other people. The otherness for you is nature. The otherness is something outside of you. And once you get this habit of pluralism, you have a hard time to understand that you suppress what they call now depth psychology, brings this very clearly out, that you simply dispress, repress, suppress all your immediate loyalties, all your immediate responses, all your unconditioned surrenders to your mother influence, to your sweetheart, to your professional ambition, to all your prejudices, gentlemen. So long have you been told that you should wipe out your prejudices, it's high time that I invite you to see the necessary prejudices, those prejudices by which we live. For example, one of your prejudices is that you should have something to eat. But a much more important prejudice is that you have somebody who must have somebody who loves you. The Greeks, you see, did not admit this to the mind, and so while they were in their schools, they fell into this vice of substituting pederasty, homosexuality, for real love. Because you couldn't have this avocation of getting married or loving a real woman because you wanted to study, you wanted to be scientific. Anybody who indulges in this overexertion of the mind, of course, is plagued by his body in some form or other, but since he has divided his mind from the rest of his existence, calls it even disparagingly body or material world or the world of the senses, as Plato calls it, he dismisses his heart and his soul and they go empty, and so he plunges for some sweetheart of the same sex. All pederasts, gentlemen, all homosexuals are victims of such mental fibers, of such mental arrogance, that the mind can get outside commitment and life and compare notes about the rest of the world. Well, gentlemen, the mind is simply between my shoulders, it's only my mind. And my mind is subservient to my heart and my loyalties.
and my mind is subservient to the needs of my existence, and I do not trust my heart, the mind, I know too much what is wishful thinking. And most philosophies are wishful thinking. How else could it be? A man alone, gentlemen, who is not satisfied in his needs, you see, of the whole person, will, by his mind's arrogance, or his mental dreams, or his mental visions, as you call it, will substitute all kinds of things. The Greek mind, therefore, gentlemen, says that the senses are unclean and the mind is clean. That the brain, the mind, the thoughts, the life of the mind is pure, and that my body is impure. The Jews say the opposite, gentlemen, and I think every man in his reason says the opposite. That the only thing that is impure is the mind, and that the whole body is a wonderful creature and is perfectly pure. It is terrible when I see today, gentlemen, you are all confused. You are all three-quarters Greeks. And you think that when you read in Plato or by reports, by indirection in modern philosophy, that you have to accept it just and criticize that really your body is unclean and that your reason is divine. And I have never seen a divine reason so far, gentlemen, but I have seen divine beauty in bodies. And I have seen divine hearts and divine souls. The mind, most people I know, gentlemen, are stupid, lazy, prejudice, blind, wishful thinking. I have never seen a pure mind, and I don't wish to see a pure mind. We are not pure minds. That's the least important thing about us. But we have pure-hearted people, gentlemen, fortunately, more. And most bodies, if they are chaste, should be pure. But of course, if you send all the girls in the country to the liberal arts college, you cannot expect their bodies to be very pure. I'm very serious, gentlemen. You have to reverse all your adjectives before you can understand the world of the Bible. In the Bible, the only folly is committed by the mind. Otherwise, men can walk humbly with his Creator if he follows the wisdom of his heart. And the problem of the devil on earth is to whisper into your ear that your mind can be separated from the body. When Adam goes through the garden and Eden, is a very simple story, gentlemen. It is not a myth. It is simply the shortest way of expressing your own predicament and my predicament. Adam and Eve have done something together which they were not expected to do. Whatever that is, it's absolutely indifferent to the story. And the first thing the mind whispers into the ear of Mr. Adam is to say, I didn't do it, she did it. And the lady, of course, says the serpent did it. That's what the mind can do. Get yourself out of your immediate responsibility. Somebody else has done it. Don't you know that this is the beginning always of every world war? Somebody else is at fault. Or of the Jewish persecution of the Jews by Hitler. The Jews have lost the war, not we. Always when you say somebody else did it, gentlemen, your mind tries to get outside the loyalties of life itself. We are deeply immersed in anything what happens ourselves, totally. And the only the way in which Adam could have solved the question, you see, put before him was that, of course, I did it. And I should have been stronger than my wife. I was, after all, the husband. And according to the old theory, the husband is the head of the family. I forgot that. And she did it, you see. And I'm sorry. Instead, he said she did it. That's the whole story. Wherever you have companionship and unity, gentlemen, you break up the paradise, the heaven on earth, when one of them dissociates himself from the responsibility and says, I did not do it. Somebody else did it. This is very simple. And we do it all the time. Now, the whole biblical tradition, gentlemen, against the objective mind says this one sentence, gentlemen. Nobody can be saved unless everybody is saved. It's the story of the solidarity of the human race. The Greeks say, we go to Persia,
we go to Egypt, they are foreign. Look at them, they are barbarians. The Greek word for the natural word among people is barbarian. Thereby they are dismissed. You call them uncivilized, or you call them primitive. It's another way of getting out of your responsibility for the Red Indians. They are primitive, so what else can they do? They must die. Take away their land, put them on these miserable reservations, because they are utter primitive people. What do you expect? They don't know how to play on the stock exchange. A friend of mine had to serve with Bavarians on the Balkan front in the First World War, and we were allies then at that time of the Bulgarians. Now the Bulgarians are ready peasants, and the Bavarians are ready peasants. And they were, in my friend's eyes, there wasn't much difference between the two contingents, and he liked them both. And he asked his own troops, where are the Bavarians? Now, my dear friends, tell me, he was a sergeant, staff sergeant, tell me, why don't you like the Bulgarians? And they said, they have no culture. And he was very much surprised because he thought the Bulgarians had no culture. But he said, now you think this over, that's nonsense. You tell me what you really mean. These Bulgarians are wonderful people, they are courageous soldiers, they are brave, honest, frugal. Why don't you like them? So, after much deliberation, next day they came back and said, Staff Sergeant, we know it. They have no culture, they don't drink beer. That is, by and large, gentlemen, the way in which we always get out of our solidarity with other groups. They don't drink beer. So, Adam got out, of course, because they had a wife on whom he could put the blame. The Jewish mind is a very subdued mind, because the Bible opens with a story against the mind. The Bible is written against the mind. The Greek story is written for the mind. And the two pleading, the Bible tries to plead for the heart against the mind. And the Greek says, even the heart must be subdued to the objective mind. Even our women folks must be substituted, must be replaced by male sweethearts or by prostitutes, because the mind comes first. We are great scholars, we are great geniuses. I knew a girl here in this country, I saved her from suicide, as a matter of fact. She was so Greek that she said, well, Verlaine had to murder his father-in-law because he wrote such a wonderful poem afterwards. And since we get this wonderful poem, it was worth the assassination. That's a Greek mind, you see. In defense of high art and performance, you first must have the sensations of Monsieur Baudelaire and his Fleur de Mal and Mr. Proust.
Since we have a lady present, I can't tell the story of Proust.
You become a pig so that you can write an interesting book on pigs. The Jew says it isn't worth it. Even the bestseller on pigs shouldn't be written. This is a constant battle, and therefore you see that today it is not outside. You have no longer definite institutions of peoples. You have no longer Jews and Greeks, but you have the college and the church. In many ways, they have now taken over this role, that they replace, you see, the influence of the Bible on the one hand, where the mind is put in its place, subordinate to your real loyalties. What can you do for curiosity's sake, gentlemen? The Greek answer is everything. And the Jewish answer is nothing. Curiosity is out, the Bible says. Wherever there is curiosity, there is a curse. Curiosity is not good enough. if you want to save lives, and you must go into vivisection anatomy, then it must be predicated by a real wholesome profession of medicine. But if you discover, as they did in the 17th century, the power of arsenic, as you know of arsenic, you know, Louis, what is his famous play? We all live in arsenic. In the 17th century in Paris, they were all murdered by arsenic because the chemists, just for curiosity's sake, had discovered this poison, and they sold it to all the aristocracy, you see, to get rid of their worst enemies. And there's a famous novel by Madame de Scudery on these trials against the arsonists. You see, that's curiosity of first running riot and then doing with it what you please, not under the discipline of a medical science. You don't know, gentlemen, that we live after 300 years of a harsh struggle, that all the medical experiments should be under control and devoted, dedicated to a purpose. And all the time, again, the curiosity seekers try to get out of control. Takes a salt vaccine. It should not have been implied. It's too early. Curiosity, sensation, newspapers, about so much pressure on these poor men that it was used too early, and so the people get the now polio when they are vaccinated. Just had the day a telephone call that this has happened to a friend of mine, his son, his only child. Why? Great mind. It's just doing something for publicity. Terrible. When this was invented, a friend of mine who has some experience in these things said, it is obviously too early. You cannot have a vaccine. This was before anything was done with it, by the way. You cannot have it. It takes some more years. I just know this. It's wrong. But the great mind, you see, having not this discipline of making it really serviceable, but having only the sensation of knowing something, will always go to pieces. Always. The Bible, gentlemen, freed men by insisting that he could rest. The mind is restless. The Jew Bible begins, as I told you, with the Sabbath. And I want to say now a word about this strange principle of the Jewish faith, or the biblical faith, because it is, of course, today a universal faith. It is no longer limited to the people who call themselves, who are born as Jews. It is our own general heritage to know that we are outside the constant maelstrom exemplified in our body mostly by the restless working of the mind. The mind cannot rest. It is bored. You have always to feed it new things. You read the newspaper as an argument, as a proof that the mind needs constantly new whole forests from Canada. Every Sunday we consume a big forest in Canada just for curiosity's sake. Because the mind cannot stand still. Now, as you know, the Jews have done everything to eliminate this curiosity at least one day a week. The English Sabbath is still an example. All Americans and Germans, by the way, to poke fun at the English because they must be so bored on Sundays. They actually do not do any thinking on Sundays. That's quite an achievement, gentlemen. There are no sensations, there are no news, there are no records, there are no games, you see. You can hardly understand such a Sunday. It was an absolute negation of everything you call a good time. Because the Sabbath is not having a good time. It is having time. That's the opposite from having a good time. Having time. So that you can free yourself from all the humdrum and all the cluttering up debris of yesterday. How is this then, gentlemen? There's one secret which you find in no book, strangely enough, never mentioned. Theologians are poor livers, they are all Greek. Theology is another way of looking at religion from the Greek school board standpoint, ready for examination.
What you call theology, gentlemen, is an attempt of the Greek mind to dominate our faith. Yes. You will find out about this, Mr. Davis, when you go to Union. That's just a Greek place. What's the difference?
The Sabbath pays no attention to the life of the family or to the life of the heavens. One item in the Sabbath is so very strange, it rolls across the years. All former calendars and all later calendars, especially the calendar now recommended by the American Chamber of Commerce at this moment, tries to squeeze the Sabbath and the week within the year. So that, and every January 2nd, let us say, there would be a Monday, because the 1st of January would always be a Sunday. The provocation of the Hebrews, by which they have created all their hatred against them, is that they say, frankly, that their Sabbath defies the astronomical and the family calendar, because one year it will be Friday on January 2nd, and the next year it will be Thursday, and the next year it will be Wednesday. Now, you say, well, I'm not interested. Is this important? Gentlemen, it's terribly important. It was the Magna Carta of Israel that against the Babylonian or Egyptian or Roman or Greek nonsense of calendars made in the sky by observation from the observatory, men's freedom was guaranteed, that regardless what was in the sky, and always on a different day, the Sabbath, regardless against which constellation prevails, the Sabbath came against the New Year, against the holidays. I've made you right on the holidays. You know how adamant they are with their date. Not one of you in writing on the Sabbath has noticed that the Sabbath cuts across all these niceties of 4th of July and 14th of July or 5th of November, because it is every year quite a different day that has to be celebrated. Don't give this up, gentlemen. You don't understand. Chambers of Commerce are very diabolical. They tell you this with regularity, and they tell you how wonderful. 50 years from now, you already know on what day Easter will be. It will be always on the same day every year. As soon as you agree to this, you will be slaves to a superstition. You see, the Chambers of Commerce in this country are the most superstitious institution in the world. They even believe in the business cycle. They believe in everything that's Egyptian. Now, it is very hard for you at this moment to believe me, gentlemen, that such a small thing as the going on of the Sabbath across the walls or the frontiers or the end of, and the beginning of the year could contain any element of political or moral freedom. But I assure you, it was only in this suggestive and small manner that they could worm their way into these big empires. Think of this small group of Jews living now for the last 2,000 years in all these empires, you see, with all their superstitions. And they lived already long before Christ came, you see, in Egypt, in Rome. We find them there by the thousands. It is only by this little bit of the Sabbath freedom that they could fight astrology, all the superstitions of the horoscope, all these tremendous celebrations when the Emperor of China published his edict every year that the words, you see, of the flood and so on would condemn everybody to do this as his grandfather had done from time immemorial without any change. So small is a dynamite, gentlemen, that blows up a big castle, that simply this is the difference between a Babylonian week and a Jewish week. You see in many books, they are all, of course, written prejudice by these so-called Greeks, they are agnostics, they are
they are, of course, all on the Greek side, that after all, the Jews only took a habit from Babylon or another and imitated their week. Gentlemen, there is only this very small difference, which is the difference of the whole two worlds, that in Babylon, they celebrate every 10th day, but every new year, the whole calendar begins again. Same was, by the way, the case in Mexico. You see, the new year begets the order of the whole year. And therefore, it's all dependent on priesthood, it's all dependent on a clergy and on a emperor, a priest emperor, and the individuals are simply part and parcel of this cosmic juggernaut which comprises them. But in the Jewish Sabbath, you are made independent from all observations, and you know they went so far that even the new moon had to be observed, because they didn't want to have any observatories, any religious astrology. The whole uncertainty about the Jewish year comes from this very empirical attitude that they said, we have no priests, we have no Egyptians, we have no Roman priesthood. We look at the sky, and if it is now new moon, we'll have it shouted out. As you know, every New Year's Day in biblical tradition had to be observed actually in the sky, quite afresh, regardless of any writing, of any scientific astrology, of any horoscope. And then the messengers rode as fast as they could to all parts of the Mediterranean world, proclaiming, yes, this year again, God in his great mercy has really allowed the moon, you see, to be regenerated. Therefore, we can celebrate the New Year's Day. And so the Jews kept their what we would call their nose to the grindstone or their grassroots stance, and they never got off, never their real existence as creatures on this earth to be lifted up into these lofty speculations of scientific men, of astronomers, or of any such physicists or psychoanalysts or whatever you have today taking the place of these tremendous systems of ancient thought which tell the living what they have to do because it is written in the stars somewhere, or it was done by our ancestors. See, Israel says we live in the future. We still wait for the coming of the Lord. He hasn't come yet. We believe in the Messiah. And therefore, the Sabbath is the pawn in this whole game, that they believe in the future. Sorry, I have to end. My story just begins.